Hello and welcome to We Own This Town Music, the podcast for showcasing new and notable music from Nashville and surrounding areas. I am your host, Michael Eads, and this is volume 180. This week, we're going to sit down with a very special guest for an interview episode. If you've not heard of Joni by now, your ignorance is not bliss. More on that in just a moment. As with every episode, I want to remind you that this show is brought to you by We Own This Town, a podcast network of entertainment and documentary content produced by Nashville residents for a nationwide audience. How's that for a new descriptor? Maybe a bit much. I think it's a little snazzy, and it's absolutely true, but it might be a bit much. Every show on the network is available on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, Google Play, or wherever you like to listen. You can visit us at weownthistown.net or find us in all the big three social networks, Instagram, Twitter, and Facebook, at weownthistown. You'll get some updates on all our new episode releases. For instance, Filmography Club recently released a new episode continuing their dissection of the work of Paul Thomas Anderson by taking a look at The Master, one of his denser films. Nashville Demystified released an episode interviewing Sean Nelson, a writer and musician who recently moved back to Nashville after a long stint in Seattle. You likely remember him best as the singer of the 90s band Harvey Danger, but he's got a lot more to offer than that. Though honestly, Flagpole Sitta was a legit good song. Check out both those episodes. They're fantastic. Excellent listens. We've got plenty more coming out soon. New episodes from Thick as Thieves, Liquid Gold, Bandsplainer, Hot Minute, Ladyland, all the hits. Honestly, great stuff coming your way very soon. Just go over to weownthistown.net, follow at weownthistown. You'll get the skinny on everything as soon as it happens. But this week, I sit down with a guest that I've wanted to talk to for a very long time. And I'm happy to say that the wait was worth it. Joni is often cast as a pop musician here in town, but that label only gives credit for a tiny slice of everything he's involved with. He's a producer first and foremost, working with a lot of different artists around town. He's a musician in the middle of a release cycle for his second official EP. He's a supporter of the DIY scene through his involvement with the now sadly defunct Uko Studios. And he's also a podcaster himself, hosting a fantastic show called Yada Yada. We cover all of that in detail in our discussion, along with plenty more topics, and it is truly a delightful time. I really appreciate him coming in, and I really appreciate you tuning in to listen to our chat, which you are about to do. But before we dive into that, I'm going to play his latest single called All the Time, which is now streaming on all of the various streaming platforms. The full EP that it is a part of will be out at the end of the month. So here we go with All the Time, and followed directly by my interview with Joni.
All the time.
All right. Well, that was Joni's All the Time, who is now joining us for a conversation about who is Joni. So thank you so much for joining us. I've been wanting to talk to you for like kind of a while.
Of course. Thank you for having me. I really appreciate it.
Yeah, you are involved with a lot of things, and I think it's going to be really interesting to try and cover all those things.
Yeah.
So I would like to start with just the core concept, which is you're a pop musician living in Nashville. Would you agree with that statement?
I would say that's accurate. I tend to lean more towards my identity as a producer than a musician, because there's a lot of nerdy stuff I do as well that probably doesn't involve actually making music, but just like working in the studio, mixing, working with artists, writing. When I think of musician, I think a lot of performance. Performance is probably like half of what I do. Yeah. I would lean more towards the producer identity.
Yeah, I think that's interesting that you mentioned the performance aspect of it, because I've found with a lot of the pop music, particularly in the Nashville area, that isn't as much of a thing. Mm-hmm. It's more about the music itself and releasing those things and collaborations, etc. So I think that definition of artist, maybe just for myself personally, is kind of changing a little bit.
And it's such an evolving world in terms of music technology, where you don't even have to necessarily be a musician in order to make music. You just need a copy of GarageBand and a laptop and your keyboard, and you can start making beats.
But that's a musician.
Yeah, exactly.
That counts now. Yeah, it's amazing. Okay, so producer, would you say more in the pop vein, or would you just, you feel like maybe that's pigeonholing you a little bit?
I think pop is a convenient way to describe my music. I do a lot of different things, a lot of dance music, a lot of R&B, some hip hop. I come from a primarily rock background.
Interesting.
I played in a lot of shitty indie bands and like punk bands in high school.
It's the best kind, shitty indie.
Yeah. Played in many a like punk house in my early days.
Yeah.
I'm primarily a guitar player, if anything. And so that kind of leads to my more rock influences. So I do a little bit of everything, I would
say. Well, that's an excellent lead into just a little basic biography of you.
Sure.
You are not a Nashville native.
Yeah.
You are from Memphis, if I recall correctly.
Mm-hmm.
Just walk me through how you got from Memphis to here and how long you've been here, etc.
Yeah. So I grew up right outside of Memphis in a suburb, Carville, Tennessee. Pretty sleepy, very like sheltered suburb. Wasn't a lot of music. And when I went to high school, met some friends, started a band, played in a lot of like punk, pop punk, kind of grew up around the Memphis punk scene, which at the time was a lot of Goner Records bands like Jay Retard. I'm trying to think of other ones that come.
I think Goner is such a catch-all.
Yeah.
Like that's just a genre in and itself.
Yeah. And at the time, this would have been probably like 2008, 2009. It was right before Jay Retard died when I was in high school. And it was really cool to grow up with that music because it was people recording in their bedrooms on really shitty equipment, but it sounded very unique and interesting.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think that was kind of like what really hooked me into music, was knowing that like, oh, I don't have to pay $1,000 a day to go into a big bad studio with a big bad console.
Yeah.
I can make records on a tape machine and it sound the way that I want it to.
Yeah.
So that was kind of my like introduction to music and recording. I came here to Nashville for school. I did the like indie singer-songwriter thing when I first got here. Those records have been banished from the internet. So don't even try. Yeah, I had a little like acoustic thing for a while. Figured out that I hated that, but still loved the aspect of Nashville that was songwriting. And so started a band called 12th Street Social Club. And that was kind of my introduction into like surf indie music. Played in that band for about 3 or 4 years. And then when it disbanded, I started my solo project, Joni, which has now become kind of a more like producer project. It's kind of my sketchbook.
Yeah. Noticed on your Instagram recently, in part of promotion for this new single, which is part of a larger release, I believe.
Yes.
That you were kind of summarizing 2019 and saying, a lot of things happened that were great for me this year. I produced 4 records.
Yeah.
Do you want to divulge what those 4 records are? Are they still unannounced in the nether?
Sure. They haven't come out yet. One record is with a young artist named Aspasia. It's kind of an indie pop record. She came to me because she liked a Nashville band called Coin. Mm-hmm. I had played as a rhythm guitar player for Coin while I was in school with those guys and have been friends with them and have mutual influences with them. Another band called Mugs, which was my friends that were affiliated with Uko Studios, which was the studio that I worked out of up until its recent demise.
Oh, we'll get there.
Yeah. I would say they're like an indie punk, garage rock type group. Really excited for that record to come out. I got to get really weird with the production.
Nice.
There was a record that did come out by a guy, Zach Rutstein, who he has a band called ZR3, and that record is called ZR3. That came out last year. And then I lumped the 4th record. I do a lot of online remote production work.
Yeah.
Just being hired to like, hey, can you make this beat for me? So I kind of
that counts.
Loop that into like my 4th record.
Yeah, I think that counts.
Yeah.
I think that's so interesting that maybe this is true of any town of our size, but it is such a small group.
Yeah.
And there are definitely distinct pockets and there's definitely different genres of music that kind of interact with one another. But the fact that you went to school and you kind of did this acoustic thing that you eventually abandoned, but you were friends with Coin.
Yeah.
And then you got to be the rhythm guitarist in Coin.
Yeah.
And then that led to production work here years later.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that's a funny thing,
yeah.
I think. I would imagine in some of larger metropolitan areas, that doesn't really happen as much. It's harder to connect. It's harder to like just know like, oh, I liked Coin. This person was in Coin.
Well, it's cool to see your buddies that you start off on such a simple level at. Like I met those guys because I lived next door to Joe in our dorm,
mm-hmm.
and he needed to borrow a guitar amp and I had one. This was long before they had any music out, any success whatsoever. And then to have a client of mine being like, I want to sound like Coin. It's like, oh, cool. Like I knew those guys way back when it was just like nothing at all.
Right.
So it's an interesting context to come into records with, especially now that I've been in Nashville for about 8 years and been able to see friends' projects kind of go up and down and sideways and people to start solo projects and side projects. Mm-hmm. And I feel like 8 years is a good amount of time to see all different types of trajectories in a career in music.
Yeah, and I think you're involved with a scene that I talk about this regularly on the show, but a scene that I'm not like massively familiar with.
Sure.
I keep dipping my toe in and trying to learn more, but that's the pop scene in town.
Yeah.
And obviously there's a lot of overlap between pop and electronic and even a little bit of shitty indie. But there's pure pop outfits. Like I found Freak Daddy last week.
Yeah.
Like that just sort of came into my world very recently. I was like, oh, this is a Nashville thing.
Yeah.
This is nuts. Mm-hmm. That this is a Nashville thing in the best way.
Yeah.
With 8 years of experience, would you say that you were primarily involved with that? And if so, or even if not, how do you find that pop scene to be? Do you think that it's still the trajectory overall is blossoming?
Mm. I would say it wasn't until the last 2 or 3 years that I was involved at all in pop music in general.
Okay.
I've always loved pop music. I grew up in the boy band golden era.
Sure.
I had every NSYNC, Britney Spears, Backstreet Boys
right.
record. And so fell in love with that kind of like Max Martin produced universe, but never really participated in it, mainly because I didn't know how to make those types of records.
Yeah.
But yeah, it wasn't until 12th Street broke up that I was involved in any scene outside of the like rock scene.
Mm-hmm.
There's always been a really strong East Nashville garage rock scene, and 12th Street was kind of a part of that. And we played with a lot of bands like Final Thief, other bands that kind of once we all broke up, we all kind of started our pop
right.
projects post our punk indie,
right,
indie electro projects, which I think too, a lot of that lends to just the musical landscape and how tastes have changed, mm-hmm, but also just the way in which people make music. It's so much more accessible to make music on your computer, to have samples and synthesizers just on your laptop, as opposed to coordinating four different schedules,
right,
with band members and trying to find a practice space and trying to book a show and so-and-so can't get off work. It's like, I'm just going to bring my Ableton rig and that's my drummer, bass player, guitar player, all that.
Right. You're also navigating fewer egos in that position, which is,
sure,
you know, I'm sure you're in bands with friends,
yeah,
but, you know, if you just get to sit in your room by yourself and sort of create these things,
yeah,
you're not having to be like listening to someone else's ideas about the bass line.
Yeah, like, they're both beautiful experiences in their own ways. Like, there's pros and cons to being in a band with four different people and the kind of deliberation and collaboration that comes along with that. And there's also a beautiful aspect of being able to take something from start to finish completely by yourself.
Yeah.
I think when I have the most fun making music, it's somewhere in between, to where I can write with someone that I am really passionate about what they do, or I just think they're brilliant or creative, but also I have the space to kind of take it into my world and say, I'm going to put the finishing touches on it.
It makes sense that you're in the producer role.
Yeah. Yeah, for sure. You know.
That's, you've just described it to a T.
Uh-huh.
It's perfect.
Exactly.
So you go to school, you've abandoned the acoustic career. Thank you for doing that.
Of course.
And then you enter more into like production, maybe still in some indie rock bands. Where along those lines does UCO Studios come in?
Yeah.
And tell this listening audience exactly what UCO Studios is.
Yeah.
Or was, sadly.
Yeah. I will tell the origin story, because I think the origin will kind of lend to what it became. There was no grand plan of turning it into anything,
right,
when we first started. But I had known Eric Maynard through going to Belmont. He also played bass in some of the very early Joni shows in like 2016. And we had kind of concocted this grand plan of, oh, maybe we could start a creative co-working space where people who do photo and video and music could all just kind of have a office in a house or something.
Wonderful idea.
Yeah, exactly. It never really came to fruition until a mutual friend found this house that was on White Avenue in kind of the Melrose area of Nashville. And this house was previously a 90s Christian contemporary music studio.
Oh,
and
goodness.
Had not been lived in a few years. I'm not sure the exact time period, but it was essentially abandoned and the owner was just waiting to sell it. And apparently this mutual friend knew the property manager for that house and convinced him to just let us rent it. And when we got in there, there were like no doors on the inside of the building.
Ooh.
Someone had like stripped all the doors out.
Kind of odd for a studio.
Yeah, exactly. Just this cavernous like maze of,
yeah,
rooms. And weird things like all of the wallpaper was super goofy and like it looked like a CCM studio. and from, you know, 1994, which was kind of awesome in a way. It had tie-dye floating bass traps on the ceilings and this weird Egyptian hieroglyphic wallpaper and fake brick wallpaper. And there was a fake sewer. This is going off on a tangent, but it was a wacky house.
Yeah, it sounds like it.
But it was dirt cheap. And the best part about it was someone had built a studio onto the house. So live room with really tall ceilings that sounded really good. And then a control room with a window facing into there, an ISO booth. Like, it had all the makings of a studio. It was just, it looked terrible.
Right.
And so we came in and slapped a coat of paint on it and essentially just started renting it out to people that wanted to record or people that needed a practice space for their band. We started doing art shows for photographers and visual artists. And it just kind of became this hub for young Nashville creatives to express themselves. And what we realized after just one or two events was that there really wasn't anything like that in Nashville. a non-pretentious kind of democratic space for young people specifically to show art. There's plenty of music venues and recording yep. studios and art studios in Nashville. But if you've ever been to like an art crawl or anything like that, it's not, if you're a young person first starting out, it can be somewhat daunting to jump straight into that world.
Absolutely.
Even as an old guy, like it's daunting for me and like, oh, I'm not cool enough to be here. But it kind of, it became this really cool thing of we would throw shows and
massive backyard.
Yeah.
Massive.
Yeah, that was probably the best perk. There was a full acre backyard and we built a stage out of plywood. And a huge plus was this house was in an industrial district. So there was no one living within probably a half mile. So sound was never an issue. So we would throw these shows in the backyard and have at one of the largest shows, we had 200 people and you could hear it down the street, but it wasn't bothering anyone.
Yeah.
So yeah, it just it became this cool community of a bunch of, you know, weird art kids or weird punk kids, weird hip hop kids. It was cool just to have a space where it didn't matter what your thing was. You could just show up and hang out and have a good time and listen to music and explore new art and, you know, break bread with your fellow totally. Weirdos.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, I'm not a youngin in Nashville, but I went to a couple things there. And, you know, it's in the backyard. For anyone that's curious where this was, if you know where the emissions testing mm-hmm. center is on Bransford, it's right behind that. Like it backed up to yep. that driveway. And it was perfect because it was so quiet and there was nothing around there. And I would go as an oldie, legit oldie, and people were just like, hey man, you want a burger? You want a beer? Yeah. Like they don't know me from Adam. Like yeah. it, just so welcoming, very happy to have me there. Like you had vendors set up at some of these events, mm-hmm. like selling vintage clothing or other antique type items. And everyone's just so nice.
Yeah.
You know, you can go to lots of different events and people just kind of scowl at you and like wait for you to start the conversation or whatever. But everyone was just wildly affectionate at yeah. these things, which was nice.
I had always heard of kind of DIY houses before my time being these kind of bastions for, you know, kind of a similar ethos of we accept everyone. It doesn't matter like what your genre of human being is, yeah. You know, show up with whatever like fashion aesthetic you are and you'll be accepted. But my experience going to college here and making music here was like, it felt like there were a lot of different scenes and kind of niches. And mm-hmm. I never really felt like there was one for me because I never was like fully in the punk scene or fully in like garage rock scene. And so I feel like Uko was that. It was just like the greatest hits record of DIY.
Yeah,
ethos.
Absolutely. And I think that's been happening more around Nashville in general over the last few years.
Yeah.
And I think Uko definitely contributed to that in a big way. I think Dark Matter has helped kind of continue
definitely.
That lineage a little bit. I am sure there are other house venues that are doing similar things
yeah.
that I am too frightened as an old person to go to. But I love that. And
yeah.
I think you're totally right about the like segmentation of genres. Like mm-hmm. there really is a thing in the rock world of Nashville, particularly, you know, I kind of came up in the 2001 era. Like that's for me, that's post-college
yeah.
living in Nashville. And it's very much like, these are the rock bands that mm-hmm. do this, and these are the rock bands that do that.
Yeah.
And they're kind of apart from one another. And mm-hmm. I think this latest wave of musicians that have been coming up the last couple of years, there is a lot less of that, and it's really wonderful.
Yeah.
So thanks for, you know,
oh,
helping to, you know, you at least gave a place for that.
Well, I honestly can't take...
No, you should take 100% credit for the whole thing.
I have to really give credit to Eric Maynard, who was kind of the visionary behind Uko Studios, and Patrick Seawalk, Mark McMahon. Those guys all lived in that house and put way more blood, sweat, and tears into it than I ever did. But I was very fortunate to be a part of it and kind of to really benefit from that being a part of our little Nashville community.
Yeah. So we keep referring to this in the past tense. So
yeah.
I think the unfortunate tag at the end of this tale is a very stereotypical Nashville story.
Yeah. So probably in September of last year, 2019, we get notice from our landlord that the property owner was going through a pretty severe divorce. He owned 19 properties and he had to sell off half of them. And it just turns out that 2500 White Avenue was on his short list to sell. To give context to it, this was a pretty shitty house in a not so desirable neighborhood. And he sold it for $1.1 million.
Yeah.
Had bought it for, I think, $250,000 10 years ago. It was a huge moneymaker for him. And we were asked to move out pretty abruptly. We had to kind of close up shop. The house has just recently been completely knocked down, and they're putting 8 tall and skinnies on it.
I don't fault someone for selling their property, particularly at a profit.
Mm-hmm.
But man, the 8 tall and skinnies, 8 in particular, is just painful.
Yeah, and the way in which it was done was pretty soulless too. It was sold to a property management group, which they had never interfaced with us in terms of paying rent or, hey, can we cut the yard this week? Like, there was no relationship there. And so it was like, hey, you got to move out in a month.
Very compassionate.
Okay, cool. And then any questions were met with like just complete red tape or, yeah, it was bullshit, to be honest.
Yeah.
And unfortunately, like, that era had to come to an end. But there are some talks of those guys all moved to a house in East Nashville that is a very similar setup. I just visited last week, and they're thinking about either kind of reformulating the UCO approach, maybe not necessarily doing shows at their house, because that is a huge responsibility to have 200 people in your home
and
environment.
Liability too, for sure.
God, yeah. I really praise those guys for doing that. I never lived at the house, so I never had to necessarily deal with that amount of interaction, but it might come back in the next year or so.
All right. Well, we will definitely keep our ears peeled for news of that. So that covers a little bit of, I think, you know, when I think of Joni, there are three primary aspects that come to mind. One is the music, number one. We'll get to that in a second.
Okay.
Two is UCO Studios.
Mm-hmm.
Check. Covered it. Now we know what that is. And three is your podcast.
Yeah.
Which I believe I've either tweeted about or written about in some capacity on We Own This Town. But let's just go through it, because your podcast, I don't know if you've made new episodes super recently, mm-mm, but there is a deep archive of really fascinating conversations.
Oh,
so let's hear about your podcast.
Yeah. So the podcast started around the beginning of 2016. It was right after.
And it's called?
My podcast is called Yada Yada, the Music Podcast. I was going through a band breakup. 12th Street had just kind of called it quits, and I didn't really know what my identity in music was. I hadn't started Joni, definitely hadn't started producing or working with other artists, and was just kind of floating for a period of 6 months, and also didn't feel very grounded in the Nashville music scene. And I was working a really shitty job where I was at a screen printing company, and I was just spraying out screens filled with ink and getting like completely trashed and dirty every day. But the saving grace of that job was that I was able to listen to music, you know, on my iPhone. And I got really burnt out on music fairly quickly, switched to podcast, and kind of had this idea like, oh, I could do podcast. I have all the recording equipment from just years of collecting music bullshit, and just thought, oh, I should talk to other musicians and just see how they're doing it, and maybe that will kind of clue me into like what my next step should be. And so I just started talking to my friends, and through that had some really great conversations, especially early on in the podcast, where it was like, I was so green. I didn't know, you know, anything about interviewing anyone. It was just having a conversation. A lot of those early episodes are like hour long, just going through a six pack with a buddy that happens to be in a band. But it was a really eye-opening experience to me where I kind of learned through doing that, like, oh, I'm more connected to the Nashville music community than I thought. And kind of learned that, like, oh, everyone kind of goes through this. Everyone's trying to figure their shit out, especially if you're a musician. You know, mental health is such a hard piece of what we do. There's no stability. There's no concrete final goal of being a musician. Yeah. You're just kind of putting quarters into the machine until you, you know, get an inkling of fulfillment.
That might be the episode title.
But it was a really, it's been a really great experience. And so I think I've done close to 25 episodes and took a break this past year just due to some life stuff, but have recorded a new season that I would like to put out probably before the summer this year. But the main gist of it is just talking to other musicians about what it's like to be a musician in Nashville. That was kind of the start. Now I've started interviewing people out of Nashville, people that I have a connection with, and just what it's like to be someone that is trying to make their living off music. There's a lot of like career talk, but then there's also a lot of like talk about mental health, talk about, you know, the shitty day jobs that you have to work, just the lifestyles of trying to make your way in music.
I think Lance Konzett introduced me to this possibly, but the archive really is really fascinating.
Thank you.
Like, I'm looking at an episode now that was posted in March of 2018 with R. Lamar.
Yeah.
And R. Lamar is like on Capitol now.
Yeah.
Like, has in the course of 1 year, maybe 1.5 years, maybe, like on a major label. Like, that's incredible. Jamie Lydell, John Santana, Nightingale, Spaz Cardigan, Love You Later is the latest one. Mm-hmm. This is a long list. I didn't mean to cut you off there.
No, I was just going to say I've been lucky to catch people early on the come up. R. Lamar is a good example of kind of like when I interviewed him, he had some success, but was able to do a major deal. I think my first episode, Ezza, she just signed a major label deal. And we did that interview in 2016, I want to say.
Oh, wow.
I had Julian Baker on the podcast early on, and she's had a wild career in such a short amount of time. Yeah, there's been a few. I feel like I should be like a A&R hobbyist, you know? I feel like I'd be a less shitty version of an A&R person.
I mean, you're kind of doing it with the podcast.
Yeah.
I mean,
just not getting paid for it.
Well, sure. Who gets paid for podcasts? I certainly do not get paid for podcasts.
I feel like I'm preaching to the choir.
Goth Babe. God, this list is amazing. I mean,
thank you.
Thad Kopeck is on here. Yeah. Mountains Like Wax. Boy Scott. Ugh. It's just, it's a really, everyone, I know this is, you know this, but go fire up your podcast app, pause with this, whatever, minimize it, whatever you need to do. Yada Yada, Y-A-D-E-E.
Yeah.
Y-A-D-A-H.
Super funky spelling.
Fun to say, though. Great logo.
Yeah.
Cool handshake.
Yeah,
lightning
thanks.
Bolts. Look it up and like download all of them, because it's really, it's such a nice time capsule of both just pop music in general and the Nashville music scene that I don't think gets enough of a spotlight, or at least it's on its way up.
Yeah.
Like, again, with your A&R skills. Pop in general is kind of on its way up in Nashville, which is really wonderful.
My one rule with the podcast has always been I have to be genuinely excited about your music in order to talk to you, because I just know that I'm not going to be able to have an hour-long conversation with someone about music unless I really connect with what you're doing.
Oh, yeah. I've had offers for people to come in on this show, which is very flattering. Don't get me wrong. Like, if someone like actually wants me to talk to them, it's unbelievable.
Yeah.
Blushing at such an offer. But if I don't really like what you're doing, it's going to be 15 minutes.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. It's hard. It's a grind to just like, so how'd you get started? Like, oh, yeah.
Great. Sounds good. See you later.
Thanks.
Yeah. So that's the second of three of the primary prongs of Joni. And then the last is the actual music. First, we'll just start with the simplest question. Tell me about the new single and what that's a part of.
Yeah. So the new single is called All the Time. It was recorded at kind of a weird time in my life.
Kind of the best time to record music, though.
Yeah. Yeah.
A weird time.
Very fruitful. A lot of songs came out of that time. This past year, I got married and was kind of in the bliss of being engaged and was just in a really beautiful spot of life where I had this great connection to people through studio and kind of the UCO community and was making music that I was really proud of and was engaged and kind of felt like I was on a good path. My mom got sick last year, and that was kind of a very polarizing thing to be so happy just with like my life in Nashville, but then kind of coming to grips with
super heavy thing.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So it was very like a bipolar past year.
It's kind of funny. I mean, it's not funny that happened, but it's interesting that you mentioned that because in my notes, when I'm like trying to describe how I would talk about this song. Uh-huh. It's like super upbeat.
Yeah.
It's like fun and dancey and just infectious, but there's absolutely a very melancholy feeling to the vocal line.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that is a 100% a reflection of what you just described.
Yeah, I love happy, depressing songs. You know, if something can make you happy, but then you read the lyrics and you're like, oh, dude, this is fucked up. Go see a therapist. That's like, that is the Venn diagram for me.
I mean, you're doing it very well.
Yeah.
Yeah. I'm sorry that you were having a hard time there. I believe your mother is better.
Yeah, right? She just finished her chemo right before our wedding and then just recently finished her radiation, is in the all clear right now. Yeah, it's been just a lot of growing up this past year. Also,
you don't have to like air all your shit if you don't want to.
Oh, this is what podcasts are for. Okay. No. I won't get too heavy. But my wife and I are moving to LA.
Whoa.
In February.
Yeah. Dropping a bomb here.
Yeah. And so there was a lot of change happening last year. And so the EP kind of deals with my marriage and just kind of the high of that. But then also some of the other songs are... One's called Contention and the other one's called Emotional. And it's about riding that wave of emotion that everyone goes through. And unfortunately, I have the outlet of music, but it was some rocky seas there for a second.
Well, I'm glad that you've made it through.
Thank you.
I'm furious that you're moving.
I'm sorry.
I'm incensed.
I feel like that's such a Nashville cliche too, like the pop songwriter moves to LA.
Yeah, I'll be honest with you. LA's awesome. And I have no issues with it whatsoever.
Yeah.
Beautiful weather.
Yeah.
Lots of cool things to see.
Yeah.
There's a lot of great things about LA. There's a lot of stuck up, pretentious, shallow people.
Totally.
There's a lot of those here too.
Yeah.
It's okay.
Yeah. And I do want to clarify, I feel like every time I tell someone like, oh, we're moving to LA, it's a bittersweet thing because I really do love Nashville, and I see the amount of growth that Nashville has had in the past like 2 years, especially in what I do, which is more like pop-centric production type work. And so it was a really hard decision because I love Nashville. I love the creative community here. I feel like it's so not that shallow thing. Mm-hmm. You know, I can write with someone and grab a beer or get coffee and... It's not as transactional. Right. I've never worked in a city like LA or New York, but I've heard that from a lot of people through my podcast. And so it's bittersweet. I love Nashville,
totally.
But it just feels like after a heavy year and just really wanting to turn the page and start a new chapter, it felt like the right decision for my wife and I.
Yeah. you're going to have a blast. Yeah. And it's not like you're going to ditch everyone you know.
No, like, definitely not.
The internet has made physical location, it's just an arbitrary sort of attribute. You know, like if you need a vocal on something, you can still call Ben Tung and get that. You know, if you need to collaborate on a beat with someone here in town, you can do that. Dropbox is a wonderful thing.
Yeah, I'm working on a record right now with an artist in China.
See?
So, and he's one of my best clients, you know? It's like, I'm a firm believer in 2020, you don't necessarily need to be in a big music city in order to be an artist. There's some business infrastructural things that can help, but in terms of the creative side, it's not a necessity.
No, absolutely not. And there are business opportunities in an LA type place.
Totally.
That do not exist here.
Yeah.
And that's okay.
Yeah.
I'm not really incensed. You know, we'll miss you, but I have a strong feeling that your impact and your touch and your involvement with pieces of Nashville is far from over.
Yeah, for sure.
So.
And my family's in Memphis too, so I'll definitely be back.
Yeah, you'll be like, oh, I'm home for Christmas. I'm going to take a three-hour drive.
Take a little road trip.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Come on back. See Uko 2.
Yeah,
you know?
Exactly.
Got to see it. So these three new tracks, All the Time and Emotional and...
Contention.
Is that part of an EP or are they three individuals? Is this Joni Tapes Volume 2? Is that what we're talking about?
Joni Tapes Volume 1 was kind of the... I'm going to throw ideas at the wall and see what sticks. And that record has like one kind of vapor wavy indie pop track, one lo-fi hip hop track. It's all...
Don't hate on it. It's
the
good.
Different shades.
It's
of
good.
Thank you.
Yes.
And I, you know, not saying that to hate on it, but it was just me trying to kind of find my footing as an artist.
Right.
I don't know if there will ever be a Joni Tapes Volume 2. Almost want to keep it at that volume one to keep people guessing.
Yeah.
So I put out three singles last year as a part of a kind of singles collection called Passion 2. And then this one is similar, but I did really focus on wanting this to be a collection of songs. Like I would really prefer people to listen to it from front to back. It's a seamless record. It's the first time I've ever done that in a production and really did focus on kind of the mathematics of making a seamless record. Like, okay, this song is in this key, that transitions to this key really well. It was a very deliberate thing to make this like an EP as opposed to just like spitting out singles.
Right.
Not that there's anything wrong with that because everyone does that.
Well, that was just sort of my next question, actually. Like the last three singles were just singles. They are coupled together. But like if you look up Joni on Spotify, they're just three singles.
Yeah.
And that's not a negative thing.
Totally.
But I'm just curious about your approach there. Is that intentional, the single releasing schedule and how that kind of is very pervasive in the pop music world versus an EP or a distinct collection of songs and the difference in the process of creating that? Like when you did Just for the Night, Say Whatever, and Orpheus, were those all done at very distinct times with very distinct mentalities? Mm-hmm. Or was it like... I'm going to write these three songs and then I'm going to take 6 weeks in between each one and release them as a marketing plan.
Mm-hmm. I kind of hate singles, to be frank with you.
Another bomb dropped.
Because it is the marketing aspect of music. The way I typically write music or just work on music in general is I write collections. So it'll be 20 to 30 just ideas. It's not complete songs. Sure. It's just kind of... experimenting with different kind of textures and sounds, and from there things naturally, you know, rise to the surface, and then that will be the EP or the collection. It does feel like we live in such a quantity over quality mindset when it comes to media of all sorts. I'm sure you've experienced this with podcasting. Oh, yeah. And I have a few friends that are like a part of the YouTube community, and burnout is a very real thing in that community. But it's like you have to keep churning out singles. And so a part of it is... I would love to do something like a full LP.
Right.
But there is a part of me that knows on a business sense, like that's just not a very good use of my time, because that's not how a majority of people in my kind of corner of music, it's not how they interact with music on the internet.
It's not your corner of the music. The systems are not designed to be friendly to albums anymore. And that's totally. That's neither here nor there in terms of like if that's good or bad. Mm-hmm. But, you know, when you work with a distributor, like mm-hmm. I work with a full-on digital distributor. YK Records that I run works with The Orchard, mm-hmm. which is like a very big digital yeah. distributor. I don't need to do that. I could use DistroKid. I could use TuneCore, all those things, which I love and recommend every artist.
Totally.
Use DistroKid, use Bandcamp. They're fantastic.
Yeah.
But I use The Orchard for the potential of reaching people at Spotify, mm-hmm. like playlist placement, that sort of thing. And it is designed for give us three singles yeah. that are put on this very distinct schedule mm-hmm. With space between them to fit with the Spotify algorithm mm-hmm. so that you have 5 weeks between singles so that the algorithm kind of forgets the previous one and then brings the next one up.
Yep.
You can't pitch two songs within a certain range. Mm-hmm. But once your album is out, it's out.
Yeah.
They don't care.
Yeah.
Like you can't have an album that was released 3 weeks ago and then go to Spotify and be like, this song is blasting off. Mm-hmm. Let's do something with it. They're like, yeah. Well, it's already out.
Yep.
They really want what's next.
Yeah.
And I'm sure that doesn't apply 100% across the board. Mm-hmm. I'm sure there's Hosono records from the 60s and 70s uh-huh. that like they do pick up on and go into the algorithm. It's nuanced. But for the most part, it is a singles game.
Yeah.
They've designed it to be about singles.
Yeah. It's tough. Like I really love records and I love the intention that an artist puts into making 12 songs to fit
right.
in a cohesive artistic universe is so hard to do.
Right.
And to do that in the span of a year is even harder, especially if you have like a day job or, you know, a family.
Oh, yeah.
It's such a huge lift to put that out into the world. And so I think naturally, now that the gatekeepers of distribution have been taken down, people can put out one single at a time. Yep. They don't have to deliver a full record to their record label
right.
to be pressed on vinyl, to be sent to stores. It's just, to me, it's a more efficient way of working. But the artistic side of me is like, no, I want to have the like album cover and
yeah.
I want to like a full collection. I want it to be like an art gallery where each piece kind of stands on its own, but it's all a part of a collection.
Well, that's clearly what you're doing. If you look at your releases, just like you release two singles before Joni Tapes, they have artwork that is all in the same style. The last three singles all have the same like color palette
yeah.
and style. I haven't seen the artwork for the next two singles, but I imagine they will look like All the Time
yeah.
in a way. So you're kind of getting that fix, I hope, a
yeah.
little bit.
It definitely, it hits that thing.
that itch.
Yeah. And that's part of the beauty of music too. And I think music's intersection with the internet is it can be so visual. But I think the next step, and I'll get there once like someone's footing the bill for it, would be, you know, the LP sleeve
oh,
with
yeah.
the insert, and yeah. then you design the label, and you have the acrylic vinyl, the color. Like that to me, to have something tangible in your hands, that's kind of the magnum opus in terms of like record album art design.
You're right. You yeah. know,
to enter the third dimension.
Yeah, it's real.
Uh-huh.
It's a real thing that will show up as a 150 pixel thumbnail
yeah.
on Spotify.
Yeah. That's the hardest part of designing album artwork. I like design and do a fair bit of it, but to make mock-ups of how it's going to look on your phone
yeah.
is kind of soul-crushing, you know?
It is, but it is an important thing to keep up with.
You got
to
do it.
Like, got to keep that in mind, mm-hmm. for sure. Or just throw caution to the wind and be like, no.
It's no, a, fuck it.
It's an LP.
Uh-huh.
I don't care about the thumbnail.
Exactly.
So when do the next two singles come out?
The second single, Contention, comes out January 24th, I believe. That's a weird midweek
I release. Saw someone tweet today, Paul Horton tweeted today, people still releasing music on a Tuesday, and I love it.
I think that's a Wednesday, if I'm not mistaken. Or no, that's a Friday. I'm looking at your cat calendar
yep.
back here.
Yep.
So that one's actually a Friday release. And then the full EP comes out the 27th. And the reason I did that was
nice.
It's that machine of like you're pitching to Spotify playlists and you have to have a certain amount of time.
Yeah.
But I didn't want, it's only three songs. I didn't want it to be three singles and then an EP.
Right.
Because you've kind of already given away
right.
the gold of it.
Right, right. That's great. So that's yeah. that's so soon.
Yeah.
We're recording this on the 7th. It'll be released sometime very soon.
Yeah.
So that's less than 20 days away.
Yeah. And part of that was the logistics of we're moving out of our apartment on February 15th. And I wanted to go ahead and just like, I don't want to have to fucking deal with this
yeah.
and be, you know, traveling across the country.
You know, I find the hardest part of releasing music to be the era of time after it's out.
Yeah.
Leading up to an album release or a single release or any, you know, all kinds of lead up. I feel like the path is well tread.
Mm-hmm.
Like, you know, oh, I'm going to contact the scene, or I'm going to contact this blog, or mm-hmm. I'm going to email all these people, and I'm going to tweet these things. I'm going to reset my Instagram to yeah. have nothing and start over.
Classic.
And you know, like, you're building and building and building. But once it's out, for me, I don't know what you do after it's out
yeah.
to, like, continue to build awareness of a thing.
Yeah. I mean, for most bands, it's you go on tour for 6 weeks.
But that sounds miserable.
Yeah. Yeah, I've never been good at the like pre-planning. Oh, I'm going to put my EP out in January and then I'll hit the studio in February and I'll have the next thing out. It's like I'm kind of just making it up as I go along.
Yeah.
And I don't know if that's a good thing creatively or a bad thing to have like rigid calendar restraints on
right.
making music. It's just the way I've always done it. But I do have friends that's like, okay, I got to deliver the album to the label by this. And then we got 6 months to write the next one. And then we go on tour for 6 months. It's just like, oh, dude, that sounds exhausting.
It does sound very exhausting.
You know? And I work on music like quite a bit, but I couldn't imagine having to have that like, okay, you have this month you have to make a record or this month you have to mix an entire record.
Right.
That sounds very creatively stifling to me.
Right. Well,
you're not
in that position.
Yeah.
So L.A. won't be so forgiving, though.
That's what I've heard.
L.A., you got to hit those deadlines.
Yeah.
I don't know if that's true. That's a joke.
If you want to be cool kid in L.A.
Right. So next up for you, obviously, is Los Angeles.
Yeah.
And plenty of adventures there, both physically. Yeah. I mean, there's so many wonderful things to see around L.A. And it sounds like I'm going to assume that you're going to be inspired to write a full-length record.
I'm hoping so. I think
your California record.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. My, you know, Neil Young or Beach Boise traveling across the country
yeah.
record. Yeah, I have a good friend, Zachary Thorkeld, who goes under the name October Tooth, who he just moved out there and he kind of said a similar thing about just being very inspired by being in a new location.
Sure.
I think part of the move was about that, just to kind of enter into a new frame of mind and to start a new chapter. I like artists that have very distinct kind of album life cycles that correlate to different moments in their life. Like I think of the Beatles that way. One of my favorite artists and biggest influences is an artist, Tori Moi, Chaz Bear. I feel like his records kind of correlate to that as well. So yeah, it'll be an interesting time.
Absolutely. There's a lot of places on the planet and you should live in some of them.
Yeah.
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 For sure. So where can people find you and keep up with all of your things?
Yeah. So website is a good hub for everything. It's joni.info. My Instagram is joni_joni_joni. Twitter is joni tapes. Those are the main ones.
Those are the ones to keep up with you from.
Those are the ones that I keep up with.
I mean, Joni, Joni, Joni is my favorite.
Thanks.
For sure. I know there's underscores in there to make it legible, but just saying like search at Joni, Joni, Joni.
Yeah. Well, there's an ASMR artist that goes by Joni. It's the same spelling and she has taken everything.
Yeah.
So I kind of had to get a little creative.
I was searching for this new single on Amazon last week, and I was like, did it leak? Can I get it early? And if you search for Joni with an E, all Joni Mitchell.
Yeah.
Amazon's like, no,
yeah.
You did not mean that.
Uh-huh.
You meant Joni Mitchell.
Yep.
It's like, no, I did not.
Yeah.
I promise.
The SEO game for Joni is stiff competition.
Well, we're going to make it even better. We're going to increase your SEO by linking to all sorts of proper Joni things with this episode.
Yeah. But also shouts out Joni Mitchell. Like,
oh, sure.
She's the OG.
But you know what? Joni Mitchell doesn't need a shout out. God bless her, but she did it. I am so thankful that you came in and talked to me.
Well, thank you.
I've been wanting to do this for a long, long time.
Yeah.
And I'm very glad that I caught you here on the tail end right before you go. This is such an excellent documentation of your experience here. And like, you know, I think I'll have you back because I think you'll be back to talk about how this whole LA, Nashville kind of blending is going to occur. And I look forward to that.
Well, likewise. I think this podcast to me has symbolized kind of something similar to what I've been trying to do, is just like pulling different pieces of Nashville together and showing the similarities. And it's an honor, man. Thank you.
It is definitely an honor. I concur. So thank you so much.
Appreciate you.
Bye. Okay, that was our chat with Joni. He dropped some bombs there in that interview, particularly that piece about moving away to LA. But I can't hold it against him. Nashville has been enriched by his presence, and it's always good to see what else is out there in the world. I mean, you can't fault someone for wanting to have additional experiences. We certainly wish him luck, and I think it's a safe assumption that his physical location isn't going to deter him from working with more Nashville artists. This is not the last we'll hear of Joni. I am confident of that. As mentioned in the episode, you can find him on the web at joni.info, on Instagram at joni, with underscores between each of those Jonis. You can find him on Twitter as at jonitapes, and on Facebook as, well, just search on Facebook. That's how Facebook works. Thank you again to Joni for coming in and speaking with me. The music bed for the show is provided by Upright T-Rex Music. Find them at uprightt-rexmusic.com. This show is brought to you by We Own This Town. Find us at weownthistown.net or at We Own This Town on Instagram, Twitter, and Facebook. You can even just email me directly, michael@weownthistown.net. Email. I get them and I respond to them. Thank you again for listening. I'll talk at you next time. Bye.